Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and healthcare. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
Dependent on a Simon & Schuster imprint? Where was his testimony? Where were these stories in real time that could have changed the course of our history?
Good evening, Brian. Bolton's conduct here is disgraceful. There's no other word for it. John Bolton was the national security advisor to the President of the United States. He swore an oath, as he's had many times in his career, to the Constitution of the United States, to preserve and to protect it, to defend it. He did no such thing. He acknowledges that the president is completely unfit, that he's incompetent at a degree that's hard to describe, that he is inappropriate, abusive of his office, that he's solicitous of foreign hostile powers to help him in his reelection. And he didn't say a word about it. Didn't go to the Congress, didn't go to the oversight committees, did nothing about it except get rich on a book deal with Simon & Schuster, which is his prerogative to do. But let's compare John Bolton to General Marshall, Chief of Staff of the Army during the Second World War, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. General Marshall, in his retirement, one of the most esteemed men in the country, would not serve on a corporate board because he did not want to be seen as monetizing his public service. He thought it was inappropriate. And how far have we come from the probity and rectitude of men like General Marshall and the people of that generation that had some understanding of their commitment and duty to the country to the John Boltons of the world, who's been an architect of disastrous foreign policy? And in his last public act, and it will be his last public act because he should obviously never serve in government again, it's to do this to the American people. What he did to the American people here is fail them rather profoundly.
Today, the president held a roundtable with governors and small business owners about reopening the economy during a pandemic. But as our friends over at the Recount pointed out in vivid detail, while his invited guests spoke and shared their stories about the struggle to stay in business, Trump was on his phone.
So increased labor would be probably the biggest effect on our bottom line. Additional employees have been added to answer the phones, and runners are needed to take orders out to the guests waiting in their car. By mid-May, sales were picking up, and we did have our best Mother's Day ever, seeing double-digit growth over last year's weekly sales.
Still with us are our friends Michael Steele and Steve Schmidt. Steve, I'd like to begin with you. I would kill to have the Curb Your Enthusiasm music to lay over that, but we'd get in all kinds of rights troubles by doing it. But here's the thing. As these people are pouring out their stories of staying in business and staying afloat, this isn't happening in just any venue. He isn't even sitting in front of just any fireplace. I know you know about where he is seated and what is written on the wall just above him.
Written on the wall above him and was inscribed there, Brian, in 1945 is John Adams' prayer that only good men, only wise men would ever rule under the roof of the White House. And if you think about our founders, they spent incredible amounts of time debating, wondering, fearing the possibility that one day the country would elect a president like Trump. And in fact, the entire American system of government is set up anticipating that moment, and we reached it. There is no president who has ever served in the White House, and we've had a couple of scoundrels for sure, but there is no president ever who is so utterly lacking in the capacity for moral leadership, for the human quality of empathy, who has any interest in doing right by the country, serving the American people. What you saw there today is someone who just doesn't care. He's not interested in doing the job. He doesn't look at those people with any love, any concern. And leadership, in the end, is always an act of love. The president of the United States has to love the country, and he's got to love the American people who fill it. And that includes all of the American people, includes Republicans and Democrats and independents and the people that didn't support and didn't vote for you. And so we just see there again on a day where 40 million people are unemployed, where we're closing up on 120,000 dead Americans and many, many more to come. We see America's decline in the world, and we see a president staring at his phone, disinterested. And understand this, that's exactly what he does in his intelligence briefings. That's exactly what he was doing when they came and told him in February and March that a pandemic was coming and we needed to get ready. He doesn't get it. He lacks the intellectual, the mental, and the moral qualities to be able to lead. And that's why when we get ready for this election, the fundamental choice is between a good man, Joe Biden, who cares, and a bad man, Donald Trump, who does not.
Good afternoon. This is Sunday, June the 28th, 2020. This is The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson, and today we're trying a new feature out on our show. Well, and it's just starting to rain outside. How about that? We got the door open here, the screen. And I'm hearing a little feedback. You hear a little feedback? Thomas? Just a little bit, huh? Well, anyway, we're going to try this Sunday broadcast and see how it works. We had a, I'm just turning my voice down a little bit. Can you still hear me good?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, good. I just turned down the voice a little bit. And we're going to have a show today, about an hour and a half. And I only did a two-hour show on Friday. But there are so many things that are changing so fast. And it's really pouring outside. How about that?
Yeah.
Turn up the AC and open up the left side door, and we're going
to... some fresh air come through.
Yeah, fresh air coming in here.
That's what we need in America, Mike, some fresh air.
That's what we need. But
We don't need to hear any of this old, stale, drunk air that is cruel. Well, you know, Trump, as you know, is not just our president. He is also a Russian asset. That's what he is. He's also a Russian asset. Because every single thing that he has done since he has been the president of this country, he has done for the Russian. No, I shouldn't say the Russian country. The Russian president.
Yeah, good old Vlad.
Yeah, he has. I guess he's trying to make sure that Vlad retirement.
I think it's more than that, Mike. So here's a neat thing about Putin. You know, people forget he's been around for a long time, even though he looks, you know, young, riding around on his horseback with no clothes on.
Yeah,
but
right.
He's a young guy. I mean, he's been around for a long time. And as a young man, he was actually part of the what you would call the KGB. Not that
that's
today,
right.
But that's what it was. But he actually was one of the leaders. And he controlled, Eastern Europe with back when we had East and West Germany. You remember it was divided. He was part
right.
of all of
oh,
that,
yeah.
that world. But anyway, if you go back and think, he was a major player at the time when the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, they had the President Gorbachev, the last president of the Soviet Union, and they knew the collapse was coming. They had bankrupted the country. And so he did the Hail Mary pass of this program called Perestroika, which was to reform the country, kind of get it like China did, put it onto a semi-capitalist, semi-socialist agenda. But unfortunately, corruption and stuff was too bad, and Perestroika failed. And so you had the collapse, and if you remember, there was a period of chaos, and then Yeltsin came out on top. But if you remember right before that, the KGB actually tried to seize control, and they had a war in the streets of Moscow. Remember when they almost
mm-hmm.
killed Yeltsin? Remember
oh, yeah.
he got on top of the tanks.
Yep.
And all
oh,
that.
Yeah. You got just
yeah.
in time.
So, but you got to think. So back at that time, there was a great shame because the Soviet Union fell, and then it broke into pieces. Because you remember all the satellite countries that were
mm-hmm.
controlled for
Absolutely.
Since the
right.
war, they all fell apart. So, you know, Germany went back to Germany, and Yugoslavia fell into pieces, and, you know, Czechoslovakia broke away, and Hungary and everybody else, and even parts of the what they call Mother Russia, real close to them, things like Ukraine, broke apart. And so ever since then, Putin's mission has been to rebuild Russia and its legend, its status on the world stage, because they used to present themselves as the worst world power, you know. And I think this is revenge. He's very much out to humiliate America and has stated so publicly over and over that he was going to do to America what we did to Russia, and that is break it down and destroy it. He wants to break it into pieces and see us collapse. So I think this is not just a retirement package for Putin, but a revenge package where he is going to see America fail. He's going to see our economy fail, and he hopes to see us break apart fully. And, you know, part of that, we've talked about this on this show, we had that agenda back a few years ago where they tried to break up the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You remember they tried to get
yep.
Scotland to go independent, trying to get
right.
you know, everybody, all the pieces, you know, Wales and everybody to go. It failed barely, but the second wave of that was Brexit, where he broke the United Kingdom out of Europe and destroyed the European
mm-hmm.
Union. And he's trying to do that here because they've already caught, if you remember during the Trump years, we've already seen these social media programs, one of which was they tried to get California and the West Coast to secede, and another one they tried to get Texas to secede, and another one, they had to get the South to secede again from America. So he's trying the same things here. But, yeah, this is all part of a master plan from Mr. Putin. Revenge on the West.
Now, the thing is, though, he never thought that at the time there would be a problem with the Confederate flag, though.
Oh, no, 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 no. I think
so he ain't as smart as he thought he was.
Well, here's what I think is a genius of Putin, you know, of the spy masters. They will throw everything on the wall, like a plate of spaghetti, and just see what sticks, right? So if you notice, he has no problem playing the Taliban in, you know, Pakistan and Afghanistan, or playing the Islamist uprising in Syria or Ethiopia or southern Sudan.
Right.
But at the same time, turning around and uniting with evangelicals from the South to promote Israel as the premier power of the Middle East in fighting against Islam there. You know, so he plays all sides against themselves, right? And I think he will pay and play social media advocate, if you will, with all of these disparate parts. So he'll tell African Americans, you're being oppressed, you need to fight back. He'll tell cops, hey, Blue Lives Matter. He'll tell the South, you need to rise up in the Confederate flag forever, right? He'll say anything to anybody and then wait and see what happens. And if one part suddenly becomes problematic, hey, he's got a hand in it, you know? And it's one of those, he plays everything against the middle. So I think he's, you know, pretty happy with what's going on.
Now, speaking about playing everything against the middle, what's the story with the secession? Now, you're from one of those big southern states. What about Mississippi? What about Mississippi and their flag?
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, I'm from Mississippi.
Well, you were down there once.
Yeah.
I
was born down that way. So, you know, Mississippi, you know, rightfully or wrongfully, is often the butt of jokes of America. You know, we often, you know, we're always in a race with Alabama and Arkansas to see who can be 50th, you know, and everything, whether it's money we spend on roads or schools or, you know, whatever metric you want to go at. But, you know, the whole South, so you get this weird thing going on right now. We got this white supremacy has kind of co-opted the entire Confederacy idea just to have a rebel flag because I guess they hate blacks so much that's the gimmick. Because you see things like the rebel flag flying in places that were never even part of, you know, the Confederacy and or even part of the United States at the time. You know, I've seen Confederate marches and stuff in states that were like, you know, territories back then. So it kind of makes no sense. However, if you look at the Deep South, the home of the actual Confederacy, you've got, you know, these people who we'll give them the benefit of the doubt for 5 seconds here. Let's say they're not overt racist, crazy, you know, lunatics, but they pretend to be historians, we'll say. Well, they pretend to be guardians of culture. And they say, oh, you've got to preserve the statues and the flags of them because it's heritage. It's a historical monument, which is, of course, BS. But anyway, the point of these usually is modern racist things, but their argument is these things have historical merits, so you should never change them. And now we get to Mississippi. So Mississippi has a flag with a Confederate symbol right on it. Bam! There's the big Confederate battle flag right on the corner of it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the only thing I'll say about Mississippi that's pro. Okay. They actually have the oldest Confederate flag state flag symbol in America.
Well, theirs wasn't made in 1950 or 40.
No.
Oh, okay.
So most of these all came out, you know, during the marches and against Martin Luther King and stuff. Right. All the whites suddenly found Confederate heritage somehow, you know. But no, these guys actually, they, you got to understand, Mississippi not only was part of the Confederacy, but it is also where the president and all the generals that survived the war actually ended up. In Mississippi, they had a nice retirement community, we'll call it, or prison camp, whichever way you want to say it. But it was like a big, giant plantation on the coast called Beauvoir. You can actually go there. It's a, it's now it's a museum. Beauvoir. It's a beautiful view in French. But they have a it was a retirement home for all of them. So they, a lot of people say, oh, the Confederacy retired there, and that's where they all lived to the end of their days, right? So it's kind of got this history of being important, even though it wasn't the capital of the Confederacy all the way through. At the end, it's kind of considered the peak of the Confederacy, right? So in a way, Mississippi's got this weird claim to Confederate history. And in the light of their flag, in their only defense they have is that it is an actual historical monument of the times. Because they formed it, it was adopted in about 1898, somewhere like that, after the war. But it was the first flag of Mississippi ever adopted. Because if you got to think back before that, they didn't have flags for states and stuff like that. But nobody cared.
Yeah, no.
Now, that's a national.
But they had a U.S. flag.
Right. So nations would have flags. Some nations, not even all nations, but it became a real cachet back during, like, you know, Napoleonic times and stuff, to have your flag on the battlefield with your cool matching uniforms and everybody in a line facing each other. Okay. So some major nations had it, but nobody else. But there was a movement at the end of the 19th century.
We had a flag in 19 during the Civil War.
Yeah, but you got to, okay, so listen, that's nations, right? But I'm talking about individual states. Often didn't have that same.
That's
the nations. They kind of claimed the nation. Remember, Confederate States of America, their own nation. They claimed to be. But
they claimed.
Yeah. Right. Look. You know, so, you know, they claimed to be a nation, and that's why I think we'll get into this in a second. But the Confederate flag and everything to do with it is a traitorous statement to America, because it is literally people who proclaimed their independence, set up their own country, and then fought America and killed more people than any war in American history. So that's a traitorous moment. Yeah, like the Nazis.
Oh.
So it's a traitorous thing. So you shouldn't have the Confederate flag anywhere. But anyway, regardless of that, let's get back to Mississippi for a minute. Mississippi was the first, it was the very first flag they ever had, because at the time, most states didn't have an independent flag for themselves. Right? You had a flag for the nation, like the, you know, the Stars and Stripes. But you didn't have flags for little things, yeah. But when there was a movement to everybody get their own flag and everybody also get their own motto and get their own, you know, state flower and state animal and all that kind of crap, they started getting flags for everybody. The very first state flag for Mississippi was the one we see today. It's a Confederate flag with, you know, some stripes. Now, in that way, and they set it up directly to commemorate, at that time, all the people were still alive. So they were commemorating the Confederacy and the leaders of it that were still living there. So in a way, it has historical standing. When they say it's a historical monument, it's the only flag in America that has that historical standing, because most of them came out of the racist movements in the 20th century when they were just doing things like, you know, yeah, yeah, all these flags that you see everywhere, you know, and statues also that they erected. Almost all of that came out
later. Didn't New York State have a flag on the...
So a lot of the states, some of the states did, but a lot of the states didn't have flags formalized.
States.
Right. But you got to think, so this is in the 1890s. They got a flag, and they had a Confederate flag on it, and they haven't changed that. So in their way, when they say, hey, it's got historical merit, they're the only state that really has that kind of standing. Most of those states in the South that had stars and bars or anything else on them adopted it only as a, you know, we hate Martin Luther King. Type stuff.
Okay, so when did Mississippi get used their flag in 18 what?
I think it's 1896 or 8.
Okay, so they adopted FOSS.
Yeah, as their official flag. It was the very first flag ever.
So
when they say it's like an original flag for the state, they mean it. It's the first flag of the state.
So all these other states didn't take stars and bars, right?
No. They had different things going on, but a lot of people started using that stuff against.
So then the other states just copied of Mississippi.
Well, yeah, and or, you know, just the Confederacy in general, because this all came from the Confederate stuff. But other states often adopted stuff only to fight civil rights.
Right.
You know, we're talking a century later instead of
but
during the wartime.
But they had the flag then,
yeah.
And then they just changed the
flag. Just the same way they you know, suddenly are putting up statues everywhere in 1965, and it's like, wait a minute. You know, that's 100 years too late, buddy.
Right.
And it's the same reason we get a lot of, you know, in the South, you get squares, streets named after people.
So when Trump says our heritage, and they're talking about a statue,
well,
they ain't our heritage.
Yeah. No, and let's take a step back. Trump, the immigrant from Germany that lives in New York. Yeah, he's born in New York and lives in New York. You're saying our heritage? Yeah, okay. Next.
Yeah, right.
Are you talking about?
His heritage was a Nazi flag.
And or the Mets or something.
Right,
you know,
right.
So he has nothing to do with the South ever to begin with. Except for his golf club that's down in Florida. You know, that's it.
Okay.
So now he's claiming to be from the South.
As a matter of fact, he didn't even want to be German flag because when his grandfather.
Yeah, his grandfather.
Was a criminal who went back over to Germany during World War I just before he wanted to be part of that because he was being run out of the United States. And he was told that he had to contribute to the war. He didn't want to contribute any of his money.
Exactly.
And the government there said, well, if you don't contribute your money, you got to start.
Yep.
And he didn't want to do that either, so he left.
That's why he came back to the U.S. He fled Germany because you had to be part of the military or pay taxes, and he didn't want to do either. Well, sounds familiar. If his grandson
and
didn't want to be part of the military or pay taxes.
And then
it must
he
be a gene that they had.
But he got involved with the KKK in New York City. Okay.
Yes.
So, all right, so go on.
So anyway, what I was just saying, you asked about Mississippi.
Right.
So the fact that this week, I can't believe, I'm absolutely astounded that they, you know, one of the most racist states in America has voted. It shows you how profound change is. They voted to change their flag. Now, it's only in the House. It has to be passed by the Senate of Mississippi, which is always more conservative, just like our national one.
Yeah.
But I can't believe it passed so well. So that's a
good
step. But I was just saying, in their defense as a historian, they have one of the only claims to historical legitimacy for using a Confederate emblem of anywhere. So in their way, they have a standing, you know what I mean? But I think the Confederate flag should be banned anywhere in America, especially what they use. They didn't use the Confederate States of America flag. They used the battle flag, which is just bullshit to begin with, and it's used only as a racist statement. But at least they used it from the beginning, is what I'm saying. So in a way, they were honest about it. You know, they're racist.
They're racist from the beginning.
You know, yeah. So, but anyway, that's my only point about Mississippi. Now, I think the stuff should be banned everywhere in the country because it's traitors. But at least their argument has a micron of validity, if you will. Whereas most places have no standing. You know, they're like, oh, we've had that flag forever since 1970.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, right. Well, there is another point with this fool and Trump did.
I want to ask you before we get into that, because I'm curious about, you know, you've got a totally different take on Mississippi. I grew up there. I know how backwards they are. But you got a different take. So I just am curious. Do you think they're actually at this time, they progressed enough? Do you think the Senate is going to ratify that, and it will become law. They will actually change their flag.
Well, I don't know, but I think we get rid of the, if we take over the Senate, it's going to be going anyway.
Well,
because there'll be the Senate, the House, and the Senate will pass a law. So they'll have to get rid of it.
I'm just talking about
the
it's a huge time of change. We got people on the street from coast to coast. It's not just regional. You know, we don't have just marches in New York or whatever. We're having marches everywhere. So enough change? Do we have a good generation that is coming in that's aware enough that they're like demanding it? So will the politicians in Mississippi react, do you think? I mean, we've got the House already reacting to Mississippi, so I'm pretty surprised and stoked.
Well, I'm surprised too that the House is up, but the Democrats control the House.
Yes,
so
that's the problem.
They control the Senate.
I don't think that is.
No. So the problem is that I don't think they will want to be the only ones.
Right, because all the other states have gone away. Now, again, just because they had later emblems and they couldn't defend it.
You're the only one with the Nazi symbol in Germany, and you're trying to defend it.
Well, let's hear it. Are they going to be? Is Mississippi going to literally be the only embarrassment left in the country, or are they going to say, okay, no, we can change? You know.
I mean, and if the Democrats take President Biden gets in. They could make it very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
On the,
well, here's my.
If you don't get rid of this, you don't get anything for any federal program.
Yes. Well, and here's my dream conundrum for the Republicans. No, I don't think they care. But here's my dream. My dream is that they actually will see the political moment for what it is. Because this is the sort of Damocles thing, you know, nice edge of the thing. They're at the moment where if they vote it down and smear in their same old plantation ways forever, you know, sitting on the porch going, bring me another one, you know. If they do that, they're going to hand the Democrats the greatest thing going into an election year ever, right? All of those progressives down in Mississippi will vote like crazy to get them out and change the flag and you know, have a little bit of progress. Because a flag is nothing, but it doesn't matter. It didn't really change the culture, but it's an emblem, you know? So they'll either change that or they'll just stand firm and then give them a great campaign ad. Mm-hmm. So I think they're at that point where I'm hoping the Republicans there will say, we're going to get our ass handed to us. We've got to do it. And they'll just hold their nose and vote to overturn it. And I hope this is the end of the Confederate flag in America. I really do.
Well, what about all the racists throughout the country? And all, not just in Mississippi, but in South Carolina, Alabama.
That's a whole other
can
of worms.
You're not getting rid of them. They'll still be here.
No. Hey, and the sad thing about racism, it's like a virus. You know, we can spread it to new generations, new people all the time, right? And unfortunately, as we saw, there's a perfect example of this. The other day, there's a little old lady caught on video, it's all over social media and Facebook and everywhere else, being horrible and racist and saying directly, I'm going to teach my grandchildren to hate you, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that's exactly how racism spreads. So, unfortunately, there is no one in America, no racist, anyone can claim any kind of link to the Confederacy. Sorry. It was over and dead over 100 years ago, right? So there is no link anywhere for any of these people.
Were there any Nazis, or as churches of Nazis, in Germany that thought the same way?
Oh, I'm sure.
Or were they – but see, they're not as big as we are.
Right. But look, here's the thing. Like in Germany, they made the decision, albeit at the point of a gun, but they made the decision after the war to, okay, that was a mistake, and we're going to abolish all of it. You know, you can't honor it or whatever. You can teach it in school, but can't fly the flags. You don't do anything.
They
didn't
grow up with
that. But, yeah, of course, it was adopted.
It wasn't indoctrinated.
Yeah, and it was invented by the Nazis.
Right.
You know? So – Right. It isn't a national thing. It isn't like, oh, the 1,000-year German flag has been taken down.
Right.
So
right.
There's no heritage to it. But anyway, they did make the leap of just saying, let's get rid of this trash. Let's abolish it in the embarrassing thing. Let's get this wipe it off. And what this country has never done yet is faced the legacy of racism. We've never faced the honest legacy, right? After the war, they attempted to, but as soon as they shot Lincoln, it was over, because when they were going through reparations, they were going through all these other things, all of that ended, and they just took the easy path of, let's not talk about it.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't talk about it in front of the neighbors. You might cause a ruckus.
Right, right.
And everybody for the next 100 years sat around going, nothing's happened. It's all good. Everything's fine now. And you hear that all the time. Oh, it's over, isn't it? I thought it was over.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's happening?
It's the same way with like Martin Luther King. Like, oh, well, he fixed it, right? So we need to be honest in this country. And I think that places like Germany, as brutal as the war was, whatever, it forced them, maybe because they had the war right there, you know, Berlin's burning. Maybe that'll force you to do things. We didn't have that here. So we didn't have like New York on fire,
right?
So maybe that would have forced us to do things. But anyway, what we should have done after the war is face it. Yeah. Well, that was.
I saw that on going.
So what they should have done after the war is face all the problems it got done with.
Right.
But instead, they put it on hold.
Well,
so now,
that's because who became the president after Lincoln?
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
Yeah.
Forget it.
Yeah. You know, I will stonewall history.
Right.
So,
right.
We've got this problem with or this legacy left over, so we need to face it, right? But the key to everything, and I hate to harp on this because we talk about this almost every time, is, you know, I come from my mother was a teacher. I love education. The key to solving this is education, right? If we educate the next generation and just tell the truth about history and say, this is bad, this is good, this happened, this didn't happen. In the end, here are the facts. It will end. It's only when you keep pretending it doesn't exist and you let, you know, great-grandma go in the corner and tell them that, you know, those people over there are worthless and not worth anything, and we used to not even let them in the house, do it again, you know, that little Bobby grows up that way. I mean, seriously. So it's like that crap needs to end, right? It's just like, look, in this country, we used to hate Irish. We used to hate, you know, all these other groups that came in. And now it's suddenly okay. You know, Italians are everywhere. They're not hated anymore. You know, so, again, we can get over anything.
Now Trump's trying to
make us hate the
Chinese.
Asians. That's his own latest just because of the pandemic. Before that, it was the Hispanics. You know, we were building a giant wall. You know, and the best part about it, the victims were paying for it. Don't you worry. Yeah, it's a free wall.
All right, we got to go because we only have another 45 minutes.
Okay, yeah, anyway,
now,
enough of that crap.
We need to get to this other thing here, and that's this clown.
You know,
this man, who's supposed to be our president, supposed to be. Well, name, he signed the paper. But he's actually the Russian
actor. He was selected.
Selected, yes.
That's what I call it. There was an election. We elected a lady, first female president ever, and then they selected someone else.
Yes. Well, this is our something that was on AM Joy today, and I think we should listen to this.
Anything to do with the election interference in 2016. Every U.S. intelligence agency has concluded that Russia did. My first question for you, sir, is, who do you believe?
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
Okay. Good morning and welcome to AM Joy. Well, you may remember that, you know, Donald Trump, he tried to walk back his sycophancy to Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. However, he is at it again. Apparently siding with Putin over American troops. Trump is now denying that he was ever briefed on intelligence, that as reported by the New York Times, the Kremlin has been secretly offering bounties to Taliban-linked militants to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Times reported that Trump and the White House National Security Council were briefed in late March. and that Trump took no action to retaliate or to prevent Russia from targeting U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. In a statement, the White House did not confirm or deny Russia's action, but it did refute Trump's knowledge of any such allegation. Trump himself is tweeting this morning that he knew nothing of the claim, and yet still has nothing to say to his pal, old Vladimir Putin, who again is accused of offering bounties for the lives of Americans. On Saturday, the New York Times responded to the White House, reporting that one official said the intelligence was briefed at the highest level, and another said it was in the president's daily brief. Perhaps most damning of all, quote, American officials reached on Saturday said it strained credulity to think that White House national security officials would be discussing such an important matter for months and even brief British officials about it and never provide the information to Mr. Trump. As Nancy Pelosi has so succinctly put it, when it comes to Trump, all roads lead to Putin. Joining me now is Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Malcolm Nance, the author of The Plot to Betray America, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer for The Washington Post, and Charlie Savage, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, and one of the reporters who broke this huge story. He's also the author of Power Wars. And Charlie, I'm going to start with you. I just want to reiterate for our audience, Kayleigh McEnany issued a statement, and here is what it said. The United States receives thousands of intelligence reports a day, and they're subject to strict scrutiny. While the White House does not routinely comment on alleged intelligence or internal deliberations, the CIA director, national security advisor, and the chief of staff can all confirm that neither the president nor the vice president were briefed on the alleged Russian bounty intelligence. This does not speak to the merit of the alleged intelligence, but the inaccuracy of the New York Times story erroneously suggested he was briefed on the matter. That does not seem credible, I'm sorry, I think to most thinking people, that something of this importance would not be told to the U.S. commander-in-chief, that the soldiers under essentially his command, though he's a civilian, he's the top civilian that's in charge of the army, that's in charge of the military, would not be told that another country, a hostile foreign country, is offering bounties. I want you to reiterate from your reporting, what did Trump know and when did he know it?
Absolutely. So the first thing I think that's important to notice about that statement is they're not denying that there was an intelligence assessment that the Russian government had offered bounties to Afghan militants and criminals to kill Americans and had paid out such bounties. They're not denying that. They're also not denying that the White House has known about this since at least March and convened an interagency meeting about it, even with the National Security Council in March. And so they also have not tried to push back on that. They're saying, well, Trump wasn't briefed, and we don't know if they're using the word briefed in some kind of highly specialized way, like maybe it was in his PDB, Presidential Daily Brief document, but he didn't read it. And then the guy who comes in every few days to tell him about what's in the document that he didn't read, didn't mention it that day or something. We just don't know what to make of that statement. The other thing that's weird about that statement is it suggests the way Kayleigh McEnany described it, it was, well, the U.S. government receives reports, thousands of reports a day, as if this was a tip that came in from outside the government when this was an assessment report developed by this government. It's not just something randomly that showed up on the stoop one day. So having pointed both of those things out, all I can say is that we have a source who said that this was briefed at the highest levels of the White House, and we have a second source who says it was in the written Presidential Daily Brief document. And that's what we have contra their statement to the contrary.
And I'm sorry, but not reading your Presidential Daily Brief, that's not an excuse. It's his job to read the Presidential Daily Brief. He doesn't feel like it. We don't care. That doesn't matter. The Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, has also come out and disputed your reporting, sir. I have confirmed, he says, that neither the President nor the Vice President were ever briefed in any intelligence alleged by the New York Times in its reporting yesterday. The White House statement addressing the issue earlier today, which denies such a briefing occurred, was accurate. He goes on and on and on. The reality, again, and just put another fine point on it. In your reporting, how early was this briefed to the highest levels in the White House, meaning not just Donald Trump, not just likely Mike Pence, not just people at the senior levels of his administration? What is his national security advisor up to? When were they briefed on this?
We believe that it was in the PDB, written PDB, some time ago, and we know that, as in, you know, not like this week, and we know that in late March, the National Security Council convened an interagency meeting specifically about this problem and what to do about it, but that since then no action has been taken. And I also, so that's what we know at this point. We're continuing to dig.
Yep, and do you know, in your reporting, how many times has Donald Trump spoken to Vladimir Putin between March of this year and this month?
So as we discussed yesterday, Joy, there was a call at the beginning of this month between the two of them. Whether there's been more, I can't say.
Okay, so let's broaden this out. Michael McFaul, is it at all credible to you that the President of the United States, that the Vice President, that the top levels of his government, the National Security Advisor, would not be fully briefed on Russia offering money, bounties, to Taliban members to kill U.S. troops?
No. If it is, how shocking that is, too. But I worked 3 years at the National Security Council, right? I wasn't just the U.S. ambassador in Russia. I worked there. I did those briefings. I was the person that briefed President Obama about all things Russian. And it is just crazy to think that I would have gotten a piece of information like that and not communicated it to the president. That's number one. Number two, if there were these NSC meetings, as Charlie just reported, how could the National Security Advisor, who's supposed to advise the president on national security matters every day, not bring it up? That does not seem credible to me. Three, I would just remind you that the fact checkers over at the Washington Post, in their book, the introduction starts with 16,000 falsehoods, I believe. So against the backdrop of that, why should anybody give them the benefit of the doubt that this is true? But finally, I want to really stress this point. If it is true, that is also incredibly shocking. First of all, as Charlie just said, they have not denied that this happened. This intelligence is not true. They had every chance to do it in all those statements, Joy. It never says that, right? So think about that. They have this incredibly shocking information that they're not giving to the president, all the while the president, one, is calling Vladimir Putin. That's a great point. When I got those packages ready for call packages to call Putin or Medvedev, intelligence like this was always in the call package. And two, he made some pretty big decisions. He's made a decision to invite Vladimir Putin to the G8 summit. He's made a decision to pull troops out of Germany. Surely in a conversation about those major policy decisions, somebody, well, I hope the National Security Advisor would say, well, hey, Mr. President, we have this intelligence that might inform that decision. So the alibi is just as bad as the alleged thing that they did wrong in the first place. And then finally, I'm sorry to go on about this, but finally, if it is true and they haven't denied this intelligence, why hasn't any senior Trump administration official denounced it? Why haven't they said anything to say this is outrageous behavior, where there will be consequences to the Russian government? They haven't done that either. It's a very strange set of circumstances. And every which way you turn it, they seem like they're really dropping the ball when it comes to the security of American soldiers fighting for our country in Afghanistan.
Yep, and Russia, back in again. Just to back up what you just heard Ambassador McFaul say, Trump has now actually postponed the summit, the G7 summit, and his calls for Russia to attend it. This was from May 30th. So, again, it points to whether or not he can deny having received this briefing, because why on May 30 did Trump suddenly postpone his decision to try to make the G7 back into the G8 and invite Russia? That's one note. Trump has, by the way, confirmed, however, for the Washington Post, their plan to cut U.S. troops, our troops in Germany. Some probably will relocate to Poland, is reported by the Post. This is from June 24th, also after he allegedly received this briefing. Quote, in Trump's view, the basing arrangements are free military power for Germany, but in the traditional U.S. military view, they are inexpensive launch points to project U.S. power against a potential, here we come, Russian threat, but also to the volatile Middle East and Afghanistan. Malcolm Nance, we know that 20 U.S. service members have been killed by hostile forces in Afghanistan thus far. What do you make of this blockbuster reporting, which I have to note, NBC News is not confirmed, so I need to note that. This is the reporting from the New York Times. What do you make of this reporting and Donald Trump's response?
Well, let me give you the perspective of a field intelligence collector who would have been the kind of person that would have gotten this information, fused this information, vetted this information, gone back and used either multi-source, multi-dimensional intelligence to build out a picture as to whether this was true. Here is something we do know. For the last 3 years, there have been reports that Russian intelligence through the GRU, which is Russian military intelligence, the SVR, Russian clandestine service, and using their private military contractors, PMC Wagner, have been operating somewhere in and around Afghanistan and have been supplying weapons to the Taliban. That reporting has been around for 3 years now. That this would have led to bounties that have been offered on U.S. service member is not out of the ordinary. You have to remember, we actually destroyed 250 Russian mercenaries that attempted to take a U.S. Oil field in Syria that was backed by U.S. special forces. So they're not against using force against us. But let me tell you this. The statements by Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary, Ratcliffe, the DNI, and now coming out of Donald Trump himself, I can tell you personally that these are lies. There is a special reporting communication system that we have set aside for very imminent, very critical threat intelligence when it is recognized and identified, which gets these reports to the desk of the president or into the president's hands 24/7, 365, in no more than 10 minutes for the initial report. Then it is followed up by subsequent reporting. Any report that they have confirmed or have intelligence that has been vetted and found to have been credible, that there was a bounty placed by the nation of Russia through its secret services on a U.S. service member, would have been in his hands in 10 minutes. I have actually generated reports like this. These reports are not normal. When this all stemmed from the Cuban Missile Crisis, where people said they didn't have the intelligence. Whether Donald Trump read these reports, whether people withheld the reports, every aspect of their response is a failure and is fundamentally based on a lie. They are dancing around the word briefed, and we have lost 20 service members in Afghanistan. That's 5 Benghazis, according to the way that they count. So what we need to do is we need to determine through other sources, whether it's the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, to determine whether this type of critical communication went through that network or whether this was, you know, some sort of reporting that came from another source and that was brought into the PDB or not. They are dancing around the word briefing, and it is disgraceful. Whether it happened or didn't happen should have been confirmed before this report went to the New York Times. And if they're denying it, then they're either incompetent idiots or they're liars. Both could be true.
And I want to bring Jennifer into this, and I want to first correct myself that NBC News has confirmed this reporting, this in the New York Times, not hasn't, but has. So that's also important to note. But I want to, Jennifer, you expect a certain response from the hawks in the Republican Party. There would have been a reflexive response. Imagine if this same reporting had dropped when the president's name was Barack Obama. Just the apoplexy that you would have heard from Republicans. Instead, it's been quite mild, I have to say, so far. But I want to first play what Joe Biden, who is running for president right now, former vice president of the United States, this was his response yesterday.
There is no bottom to the depth of Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin's depravity. If that's true, not only has he failed to sanction or impose any kind of consequences on Russia for this egregious violation of international law, Donald Trump has continued his embarrassing campaign of deference and debasing himself before Vladimir Putin. It's a betrayal of every single American family with a loved one serving in Afghanistan or anywhere overseas. And I'm quite frankly outraged by the report. And if I'm elected president, make no mistake about it, Vladimir Putin will be confronted and will impose serious cost on Russia.
There is the promise to confront Putin. That is from Vice President Biden. Now I want you to hear, listen to Congresswoman Madeleine Dean, who was on this program yesterday when we told her and talked to her about this reporting. Here is what Democratic Congresswoman Dean said.
It is chilling. It is sickening. It is And it's shocking, but maybe it shouldn't be. This is how rotten to the core this president is. He doesn't seem to have any compassion or understanding. He doesn't seem to really love this country. He doesn't seem to really understand our Constitution. He certainly curries favor with our enemies and disrespects and disregards our allies and our friends.
And now here is one Lindsey Graham, Super Hawk, responding to the same exact news. He says, it is imperative that Congress get to the bottom of recent media reports that Russian GRU units in Afghanistan have offered to pay the Taliban to kill American soldiers with the goal of pushing America out of the region. I expect the Trump administration to take such allegations seriously and inform Congress immediately as to, here we go, the reliability of these news reports. It's rather mild.
When Trump tells you he stands by the troops, he's right. Just not our troops. The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
The Lincoln Project is out with yet another devastating ad targeting Donald Trump, this time about the mind-blowing New York Times story that Russia is paying bounties for U.S. troops' lives in Afghanistan and that Trump has done absolutely nothing to stop them. And joining me now is Steve Schmidt, an advisor to the Lincoln Project. He's also a former Republican strategist and a political analyst for MSNBC. You know, and, you know, as somebody that's got, you know, very close friends and family that have done military service, this story just really just punched me in the face when I saw it. And I want to just get your gut reaction to it. Obviously, we know what your collective reaction at the Lincoln Project was. What was your personal reaction to it?
All I could think about was this, Joy. I think about the ethos of the American military, about not leaving anyone behind, about the extraordinary measures that are taken to preserve the dignity of the human soul of a soldier, airman, sailor, marine killed in action. What I thought about is the moment when the American soldier or the remaining parts are zipped into a body bag, then packed in ice and put into an aluminum casket, that aluminum casket draped with an American flag, the blue field and the 50 stars draped towards the head of the fallen. The body is never unaccompanied. It's loaded onto a military aircraft to be brought back to the United States, to Dover, Delaware. It'll be carried on to the aircraft past service members standing at attention and saluting. There will be a comrade in arms who will accompany the body and never leave that casket alone for the entire duration of the journey home to the United States until the moment of burial. Within 12 hours of death, two casualty assistant officers will pull up in immaculately press-dressed uniforms and knock on an American family's door, deliver the devastating news. There will be a funeral. The rifle volleys will crack the air, volley of three in salute. Taps will be played. And then the American flag will be folded. And it will be presented, in most instances, to a young widow with young kids on behalf of a grateful nation. And then what happens next is some Russian intelligence officer somewhere will pay off an Afghan warlord who's responsible for the death of that American. And the President of the United States knew about it, and he did absolutely nothing about it. In fact, what he did is reward Russia by helping them achieve their foreign policy aims with the withdrawal of American troops from Germany, with their admission back into the G8. And to Jennifer Rubin's point, which I'm broadly indifferent to, and I don't know, in fact, what's worse, that he knew and did nothing, or that he didn't know. And the incompetence of the administration is such that we see it in the consequences of coronavirus, where 125,000 Americans are dead and many, many more to come. A shattered economy, the corruption, the indecency, the stench of this administration will linger through the ages.
and everyone associated with it, who's been complicit, who's collaborated with it, who has defended the indefensible, the stench will linger around them too. The Tom Cottons, who have betrayed the very soldiers that he once led in combat through his complicit silence, the Lindsey Grahams, a reserve colonel in the United States Air Force, all of them. This is a disgusting moment in American history and in American life. For the first time, we have an American president who simply refuses to defend the country, the Constitution, kowtows, and gets on his knees with deference to a hostile foreign powers autocratic leader. What a rancid moment in the life of the American nation.
You know, and it's something that that seems so unimaginable. You know, we've had bad presidents, we've had racist presidents, we've had garbage presidents like Andrew Johnson, we've had Andrew Jackson, we've had Woodrow Wilson, a horrible man. But never have we had a president who seemed to have an ethos that was antithetical to defending his own country and that seemed so enamored with a foreign country. I've never seen anything like it. As we were talking yesterday in the little after show, you know, I mean, France helped liberate this country. You never saw genuflection toward the King of France. You know, you've never seen anything like this. George Washington was cousin to the King of England. There was no genuflection toward Britain. It is very strange, and we'll just put it that way. But it is not unusual for this president in the sense that on the monuments issue, on the issue of the Confederacy, which declared itself a foreign country, they said they are not America anymore. They said they were another country. Donald Trump also reveres their leaders. He reveres their generals. I've never heard him talk about Ulysses S. Grant with the reverence that he talks about Robert E. Lee. The Lincoln Project tweeted yesterday that Donald Trump will defend a Confederate statue but not an American soldier. Trump just this morning, right after denying the Russia story, tweets out, since imposing a very powerful 10-year sentence on those who vandalize monuments, statues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the vandalism has completely stopped. He signed an executive order to prosecute people who destroy the monuments of slaveholders who declared themselves to be a foreign country, and he reveres them. But he does not seem to revere the United States Constitution or its systems or its military. It is weird. It is just weird.
We're in this moment in time, and I joked around on Twitter last week that it's as if Charles Lindbergh and George Wallace adopted a baby and he grew up to be president of the United States. It's just this extraordinary moment. We spent 75 years looking, studying, remembering the fascism that we paid such a high price to defeat. And we asked the question, could it happen here? And for almost 75 years, the answer was, of course it could. Never, not in the United States of America. But we see the entirety of the Republican Party, every member of Congress, really with the exception of Mitt Romney, has completely subordinated their agency, their patriotism, their common sense, their judgment to be members of a cult of personality that reveres Donald Trump and will defend anything that he does, no matter how indefensible it is. And so we think about Donald Trump going to Mount Rushmore. That's not his place in the shadow of some of our greatest leaders. His place is at Stone Mountain in Georgia with the leaders of the failed slave state, the Confederacy. He reveres them and their symbols and their mythology as the country's trying to finally put it down and to move on from it. And so Donald Trump's priorities, every one of them seem to be aligned with the proposition of American weakness. He's weakening the country. We look like a banana republic in response to coronavirus. We are the epicenter of its death and suffering in the world. We are the most mismanaged country with regard to dealing with it in the civilized world, without any question. We look at the whole spectrum of this administration's actions, from the caging of children on our border, from the destruction of our values, the checks and balances eviscerated, our constitutional norms assaulted, the rule of law attacked, all of them in a stunning moment. And the question now is, who will stand up for the United States? Who will fight for America? Because in the end now, the American people have to do the job that our political leadership has not done. We have to put an end to this. We have to put a stop to it in November. And the American people this morning should be filled with rage, with a righteous anger that our young men and women, that Donald Trump had the gall to go to West Point and return the salutes of young second lieutenants who will soon be bound for Afghanistan with bounties, with contracts on their head that he knew about and did nothing about. I can't imagine that there has ever been a more shameful moment around the office of President of the United States in the entirety of the history of the country. We are in America's most rancid era because we have a president who is fundamentally anti-American. He doesn't understand our ideas, our ideals. He doesn't understand that it's his job to be part of the struggle to close the gap between our reality and those ideas and ideals, to do the work of Americans to make our country more just. It is a truly, truly despicable hour in the history of our country.
It absolutely is. And I believe, Steve Schmidt, you are the person who coined the term that Donald Trump is the first president of the Confederacy, because that it seems to be what he wants to
second.
Be.
Second.
The question
him and
is,
Jefferson Davis.
Second president. Sorry. Second president of the Confederacy. Exactly.
They could be opposite sides of the same Confederate coin.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here this morning. And
the opposite sides of the same coin.
Wow. Yeah. Nothing sums up this president better.
I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, like I said earlier, it's the sadness of it is the wannabe aspect of Trump. So he's the wannabe dictator king. He's the wannabe Confederate. And he's none of these. Just like he's the wannabe hero that had bone spurs and, you know, ran from the draft.
And you know, the thing is, that when the president,
there's
a say, the red president,
the resident.
Oh, the resident is good. That's good. That's a good line. The resident. When the resident became the president, so called. There was a major, major problem. He also brought up why this guy was not as good as Churchill or FDR.
Oh, my God.
Churchill and FDR, their sole thing was to never lie to the American people. No matter how bad things are, no matter how things were bad as far as what was going on in the world, that the American people and the English people could take it if you only told them the truth.
Because they still valued that thing called integrity. It's the same thing. Look, it's the same thing with Obama. When he came in, when the economy collapsed, and he didn't brag about Obama all day long. He got busy. He worked day and night. Remember, he never took any breaks. Remember, he never went on vacation. And one until the second term, he took vacation in Hawaii. And then you remember the Republicans were all like, oh, look at him going to the beaches. That's the first time in 8 years the guy took a break. But he got everything fixed, right? He didn't cry about the situation.
No.
He just got to work day one. And that's the same thing with these guys. These guys came in the Great Depression, Hitler on the march, and they just said, okay, what's the job? Let me get the business.
Churchill, and let me there is a great podcast I want everybody to listen to, John Meacham's Hope Through History. And he describes Churchill and FDR, their insight into believing in their public. Just listen to Churchill.
First, courage. Then candor. Churchill believed in leveling with his followers. He also believed that the rest of the world tended to see the world as he did. In his cosmos, there was joy in the journey. Without darkness, there could be no light. There was a fundamental democratic instinct at work, too. Churchill held out the possibility of heroism for all, not just for great men. That was one reason he so often spoke of the long story of the nation. In that story, there was room for greatness from the most ordinary of souls. Trust the people had been his father's political motto, and Churchill shared it. And the people deserve the truth, no matter how unpalatable. There is no worse mistake in public leadership than to hold out false hopes soon to be swept away, he said. The British people can face peril or misfortune with fortitude and buoyancy, but they bitterly resent being deceived or finding that those responsible for their affairs are themselves dwelling in a fool's paradise. People respected candor, Churchill believed, so long as they believed their leaders had a plan for moving forward.
His speeches were, of course, very, very important. It isn't even so much the terrific lines that he would craft. To me, it was the structure of his speeches in that period. First of all, he would begin his speeches with a very sober appraisal of what the actual situation was. He did not sugarcoat. He did not want happy talk. He wanted to convey the actual situation. And then he would follow with actual grounds for optimism, real grounds for optimism.
Roosevelt learned something from this Churchillian understanding of leadership. The news is going to get worse and worse before it gets better and better, FDR told Americans in the winter of 1942. The American people must be prepared for it, and they must get it straight from the shoulder. It was, in a way, the covenant of democracy. Give it to us straight, and we will do what it takes. Such a view sustained Churchill through all the years of war, in defeat and in victory.
I am very careful not to say anything of an overconfident or unduly sanguine nature. I am sure we have very rough weather ahead. But I have this feeling, which I must impart to you, that the Germany which assaults us all today is a far less strongly built and solidly founded organism than that which the Allies and the United States forced to beg for armistice 21 years ago. I have the sensation and also the conviction that that evil man over there and his cluster of Confederates are not sure of themselves as we are sure of ourselves.
And finally, cooperation. Churchill always knew he couldn't defeat Hitler alone. He needed America, and America was personified in FDR. No lover, Churchill once remarked, ever studied the whims of his mistress as I did those of Franklin Roosevelt. Alliances were crucial. Without them, things would fall apart.
I thought you would like me to tell you something about the voyage which I made across the ocean to meet our great friend, the President of the United States. This meeting was bound to be important because of the enormous forces which are at the disposal of these two major groupings of the human family, the British Empire and the United States, who, fortunately for the progress of mankind, happen to speak the same language and very largely think the same thoughts.
The great thing about his programs to put people to work is that he had two very different people working on the same problem at the same time, and they had very different understandings of what should be done. You had Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior, and he was wanting to prime the pump and do projects that would have a long-term impact, you know, like LaGuardia Airport or the Bonneville Dam, you know, big infrastructure projects. So he also had Harry Hopkins involved, and Hopkins just wanted to have people doing libraries, swimming pools, the Federal Arts Project, the Federal Theater Project, anything to get them jobs so they have the dignity of the jobs, even if some of these jobs may be producing something that's not going to have a long-term effect. Roosevelt liked both ideas, kept both men going, was to try experimenting with different ways of dealing with that major problem of how to get jobs to people. I mean, one of the ways that he kept up with the American people during the Depression, and he thought that was the most important thing, he said the American people will take anything on the chin so long as you give them the facts and you give them what you're doing to help. So he had these fireside chats, the first one being the banking crisis, and then a series of them during the Depression. Not every day. He said he knew if he spoke every day, his speeches would lose their effectiveness and they couldn't become routine, but everybody listened.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done and what the next steps are going to be.
So he kept in touch with the people that way, and each one of those fireside chats explained a problem in great detail. They would be a story and telling people why it had happened, what was happening, what they were doing to relieve it.
The people rallied to his side. He gave it to them straight. He never offered false hope. He told Americans that the road ahead was long and hard. But he also showed empathy. A matter of months before Roosevelt was elected president, a group of World War I veterans known as the Bonus Army assembled in front of the Capitol building to demand their bonuses. The Hoover administration responded by mobilizing the regular army to run them off.
To disperse an army of over 15,000 demonstrators, the administration calls out troops, war veterans, seeking payment of a promised bonus in order to tide over the hard times. To disperse them, tear gas and bayonets. Soldiers to disperse soldiers.
When it was Franklin Roosevelt's turn to respond, it was actually his wife, Eleanor, who confronted the Bonus Army. She took a very different tack.
And so they go out without Secret Service, without the press corps, and they end up in Anacostia in the middle of the Bonus Army encampment.
This is Alida Black, founding editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers.
And Eleanor gets out of the car, spends several hours with veterans of World War I who have lost everything and have literally been burned out of the pup tents that they had established there before the inauguration to try to lobby Congress to get their veterans' pensions early. Hoover had sent the army to dislodge them, led by MacArthur, Patton, and Eisenhower. I want you to think about this. American troops firing on American veterans. Eleanor spends time with them, sings with them, eats beans with her fingers out of 10 cups, literally at one point shares a coat with the woman, comes back to report on them to FDR. The press finds out that she goes. Then the press writes on the front page of all three Washington papers this line. Hoover sent the troops, FDR sent his wife.
How did Roosevelt do it? How did the man scorned in the beginning die a hero, bringing innumerable ordinary citizens to tears in the streets and on the farms of the country he loved? How did he salvage what seemed to be unsalvageable, rising to the occasion to lead a nation through depression and later world war? One answer, and there are more than a few, such as the complexity of history, lies in FDR's sense of hope, a spirit of optimism forged in his own experience. It's not too much to say that a man who had personally survived cataclysm and overcome paralysis was well equipped, perhaps uniquely so, to prevail over national cataclysm and political paralysis.
Somebody said to him, how can you go to sleep at night when you have to make all these horrible decisions? And he said, I don't spend time walking the carpet at night. So long as I know I've had the information I needed in the time I did, if it's wrong, I will do it over. I will make it right. I mean, I think he, maybe because he had had the polio and he had experimented with so many different ways of trying to learn to walk again, he knew that you just had to keep going until you found the right answer. And if it wasn't the right answer, you knew and you just said so.
Faith, powerful, resilient faith, was key. At Roosevelt's first inaugural, he said in closing,
the people of the United States have not failed. In their need, they have registered a mandate that they want direct, vigorous act. They have asked for discipline and direction under leadership. They have made me the present instrument of their wishes. In the spirit of the gift, I take it.
Privately, he wondered if all would come out right. A friend told him he might well be remembered as the greatest of presidents if he succeeded, but that he would go down as the worst if he failed. If I fail, Roosevelt replied, I shall be the last one. In 1932, he said, it is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something. We need enthusiasm, imagination, and the ability to face facts, even unpleasant ones, bravely. His headmaster from Groton, Endicott Peabody, grasped the essence of his old pupil. It is a great thing for our country, Peabody wrote Roosevelt, to have before it the leadership of a man who cares primarily for spiritual things. FDR thrilled to such praise. And for all the exigencies of political life, he had been shaped by and drew sustenance from the message of hope that Peabody had taught him long ago.
I remember that my old schoolmaster, Dr. Peabody, he said things in life will not always run smoothly. Sometimes we will be rising toward the heights, then all will seem to reverse itself and start downward. The great fact to remember is that the trend of civilization itself is forever upward.
Sustained by this view of progress, Roosevelt urged the nation forward.
We shall strive for perfection. We shall not achieve it immediately, but we still shall strive. We may make mistakes, but they must never be mistakes which result from faintness of heart or abandonment of moral principles. Our Constitution of 1787 was not a perfect instrument. It is not perfect yet, but it provided a firm base upon which all manner of men of all races, colors, and creeds could build our solid structure of democracy.
On April 12, 1945, less than 3 months after delivering those words to the American people, Franklin Roosevelt died at the age of 63. President never let them down. That's what you and I can remember. he never let the people down.
And that's what we need to go through. I need to have, we got another little bit less than 5 minutes left. But
a little compassion goes a long way, man.
Can we take from those two entities that we had with Churchill and FDR?
It's like I was talking to you a minute ago, though, about FDR. You couldn't have a starker contrast between a president who worked his entire life to help the people and to solve problems, including polio, which he was stricken with. And he founded the March of Dimes, mm-hmm. which is the most successful charity campaign in all history. Still going today, but he founded that. Contrast that with Trump. He is literally banned from ever having a charity because he founded false charities and stole all the money.
Well, and his kids, they can't have one either.
Yeah, and kids can't either because the kids ran the charity. But they stole children's cancer charities. Children's cancer charities. So you couldn't have a more direct contrast of personalities where one guy founds the most successful charity in the history of the world and one guy steals so much that he's banned from life from ever even doing it and being associated with a charity ever again. I mean,
well, he also can never have another casino.
No, or university. He's banned from that too. So, I mean, you got, you know, a grifter and then an honest guy. But, you know, what Meacham said was absolutely true. This guy, to the last day of his life, was working for the people, to better the people's life.
And the thing that I wanted to show here was that these two individuals, their whole essence.
And we're talking about FDR and Churchill.
Churchill and FDR. And FDR. Their whole essence being involved in the leadership of the country was to help the people, but never lie to the people.
Yeah. Well, like we talked about earlier, Churchill was literally brought out of retirement to be the president. So the entirety of the whole, yeah, think about this. The his entire legacy, all the World War II victories, the working with the Allies, the defeating of Hitler, and writing all those books that he wrote after that, all of the books on the war and on the history of civilization, triumphing over fascism, all that stuff. Everything he did was after retirement. He was brought back, and he said, "I will answer the call." Now, think about someone being so selfless that they said, you know, I will put aside my life and come back after I've done everything. I've done the military service. I've already been in government. I've already made money. I'm going to come back. And so, yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. After he lost his first campaign, he went back and served on the front line and got the Medal of Valor for it. But, yeah, now so you got people that devote themselves to their society and people who couldn't care less and only want to make money. You know.
Well, did Trump say somewhere I read that his Medal of Valor was
Bones first? Oh, I'm sorry. What?
Was living through the Vietnam War without getting the STD?
Yes, he said that. Yes, he should be getting an award for not getting venereal disease because he was sleeping with so many women while everybody was out serving. Yeah. What a guy. What a guy.
What a man.
Yeah.
What a man.
It's the same guy who, you know, says that you can't sue me for rape because I'm the president. Yeah.
Right.
But anyway, so we've got a difference in character study today. We've got presidents who care about their country and ones who don't. Ones who worship golden toilets that they have in their hotels and ones who don't. So then what lesson did we learn today, Mike?
We learned that when this man leaves office, he needs to be brought up on charges. That's what he needs.
And that's exactly
learned.
Why he is trying desperately to remove every prosecutor in New York, because he knows he's going to go down. That's the entire. His campaign should be out. Keep me out of prison, 2020. You know, that's his campaign.
Well, We are hit our break, and we got to leave. This has been a great Sunday show. Yes, 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 yes. It is a great show. Yes, the audience was clapping.
Yeah.
Yes. And we're going to go out with Blue Magic. I hope everybody has a great, great weekend. And listen to the podcast. Through History with John Meacham.
Yeah, fantastic series.
You can get anywhere where you get your local podcast. Everybody have a great weekend. Tommy, have a good weekend.
That's it. We're coming up on the 4th. Big holiday.
Yes. Big holiday. We'll not do it next weekend, next Friday. Coming up.
Yeah. Celebration of America Day.
Baby.
Dear Don.
What life has done to those like you and me.
I can recognize.
See the man with the broken heart.
Take care, guys.
You'll see that he is sad. He hurts so bad.
So bad. So bad.
See the girl who has lost the only love she ever had. There's got to be no fairer show to see. No doubt about it, satisfaction's guaranteed. So let the fashion begin. Hurry, hurry, step the moment in. Can't afford to pass it by. Guaranteed to make it cry. Let the fashion begin.
Chevrolet.